Friday morning, the 6th, is it? Or 7th? 6th of November at the camp meeting at Chico. Let's turn to the 16th chapter of the book of Matthew this morning. And we'll call the study Saving One's Life, or if you like, Losing One's Life. Matthew chapter 16. And here we have the story of when Christ asked his disciples who he was. Verse 13 and onwards, and some said John the Baptist and so forth, but Peter gave the answer, "Thou art the Christ, the Son of the living God." Now up until this time, Christ had not dared to present to these men the true picture of his mission, because he knew they had not been in a spiritual condition to receive that revelation. They thought that Christ had come as a mighty and a conquering king to set up the land of Israel again, as it was back in the days of David and Solomon. But of course, this was a total opposite to the nature of that kingdom, and Christ had the almost impossible task of breaking through their prejudices and preconceived ideas and false education to make plain to them the real and the true nature of this kingdom. Now in verse 21 you read these words, "From that time forth began Jesus to show unto his disciples how that he must go into Jerusalem and suffer many things of the elders and chief priests and scribes, and be killed and be raised again the third day. Then Peter took him and began to rebuke him, saying, Be it far from thee, Lord, this shall not be unto thee. But he turned and said unto Peter, Get thee behind me, Satan. Thou art an offence unto me, for thou savest not the things that be of God, but those that be of men." Now, if you carefully think about the reaction of Peter, you'll see it's a very, very human reaction. The man's great concern in this world is the preservation of his own life. For this reason, nations go to war, nations fight each other, and again and again you'll find, even at the individual level, that people are always concerned about how this thing is going to affect them, what it's going to cost them, and so on. And when one, especially a mother, hears about her child having to face something, then her first thought is the danger and the peril that that child is going to face. And so likewise, Peter said to Christ, "Lord, be this thing far from you. This is not to happen to you." And straight away, Jesus rebuked him and said, "These are not the things of God, these are the things of Satan." And then in verse 24, Jesus laid down this principle when he said, "If any man will come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. For whosoever will save his life shall lose it, and whosoever will lose his life for my sake shall find it. For what is a man profited if he shall gain the whole world and lose his own soul? Or what shall a man give in exchange for his soul?" I'd like to testify this morning, if there's one lesson which the Lord's been teaching me and putting very clearly in my mind, is the fact that any man and any woman who in any way seeks to preserve their own lives has entered into a pathway where they shall with absolute certainty lose those lives. Nothing is more sure and more certain. Now the commonest way in which men and women seek to preserve their lives is in self-justification. The commonest way. And you know that just as surely as you in the least degree seek to justify yourself, then just as surely will you fail to justify yourself, because others will see what you're doing, and there's nothing which is more calculated to drive people apart than a self-justifying spirit on the part of the one or the other. Now I'd like to tell a story this morning. I shall not name the characters involved, but to me this illustrates very, very distinctly and clearly the principle that if a man will lose his life for my sake, he shall save it. I know this story is true because I was a witness to it It happened in North New South Wales something like 8 years ago, roughly. Now, at that time, there was a company of believers in that area, amongst whom was an elderly man who was quite a Bible student. He still lives, and he still loves and believes this message. And this thing happened, of course, within this movement. He'd been there amongst these folks for quite a number of years, and had led them out of the Seventh-day Adventist Church when the great difficulties took place during the 1950 period. And the believers regarded him with a great deal of respect, and still do. But there came a time when a young man in this movement, who became a full-time worker in it, or was a full-time worker in it at that time, in the Way of God province, came to live in that area. And of course the layman, this brother, naturally had to step down, step down, if we can use that term, to give place of leadership to the young man who was a minister, whereas he was but a layman. To the elder man's credit, he did this rather graciously. And whereas previously he had been the main preacher of the group, the main spiritual leader, now the younger man, many years his junior, took over the work which he'd been doing. But the fact remained that there was just a residue of misunderstanding between these two men. The younger man, I believe, understood very plainly the problem and longed and prayed for that day when these two hearts would be bound together in the closest of possible unity and working. But somehow the older man did not entirely accept the younger man. Not entirely. And I can understand why, because after all the labor and work the older man put into this little group and building them up, he wanted to be very, very sure in his own mind that the younger man would truly and faithfully build up this group and not tear them apart. And that, of course, is my own personal concern today. When someone rises up to assist in this work, are they going to really be a blessing, or are they going to undo the labor of years? And so this kind of an atmosphere of tension went on for quite a long time, and the younger man patiently prayed and patiently waited, which is the wisest thing to do, for God to create a situation where this thing could be all cleared up and perfect unity established between them. The whole thing came eventually in the most surprising and unexpected way. The habit was back in those days, as I remember now, that there were two groups, one at a place called Mwillimbah and the other place down at Byron Bay, about 30 miles due south. Now the believers down at Byron Bay had no personal transport. They were anchored to their homes, and so the plan was that the group would go down from Mwillimbah every second week to Byron Bay in their cars and give the folk down there a fortnightly opportunity of meeting together and studying the Word of God. That is, every 2 weeks. Now one Sabbath when they went down there to Byron Bay, they came along for the first time a family of 10 children, and they were not under very good control. They were not particularly accustomed to worshipping on the Sabbath day, although they were members of the Seventh-day Adventist Church, and they were quite an unruly family. Well, they got together and they had the study, and the children had their separate little lesson. And then when it was over, the young preacher was detained inside answering questions and discussing things with the various folk in the room, while the rest of the folk had gone outside. Now it so happened that one of the visiting boys in this 10-strong family had brought a football along, and after the service was over he began to kick this around the yard, which was quite spacious. I guess the home stood upon about 2 or 3 acres of land, and the front yard after the road was quite large, and there was ample room to kick a ball about. Now the older man, looking on, became quite indignant about this, and what made things immensely worse was that the youngest son of the preacher joined in the football kicking. Well, the preacher was inside and knew nothing about this, of course. By and by he came out to the door. I remember so plainly, I was there and saw the whole thing happen. The younger man just got to the door, had no time at all to assess the situation, when the older man saw him appear there at the door and in an extremely angry and strident voice literally yelled at him across the space of about 30 or 40 yards, and demanded to know why he let his boy play football on the Sabbath day, and then turned his back on the whole scene. Well, of course, he couldn't have acted more rudely, more insultingly, than he did. I understood as I looked on the scene what had really happened, of course, as so often does happen. People, and there's something worth remembering in our minds, going to a person and talking to them about their difficulties is a very, very delicate work. To do it requires skill that the ordinary untrained person does not possess. And what happens normally is this, that folk understand their inadequacy, or at least they're conscious of their inadequacy in a subconscious kind of way, and they're kind of torn between the desire to go and speak about this thing in the proper way and the fear of doing it because of their inadequacy and because of the reaction which they might get. And so they hold back. And as they hold back, this conflict develops in strength and builds up and builds up until at last they just burst out and say it in what appears to be anger. And it is of a kind, too. But you must understand that when people treat you like that, it's not malicious, hateful anger. Rather, it is the result of inadequacy and frustration is the very best they can do. So be thankful for their effort. Be thankful for their effort. Don't judge them because of it. Now I looked to see what the young man would do. Well, he remained calm as calm could be, and just glanced in the direction of the older man and never said a single word back in reply. Then he looked across and saw his son playing football, and in a firm, calm and well-controlled voice he said to him, "Son, come here a moment." The boy came across and the father spoke to him quietly, and next thing I saw was the boy going across and sitting in the car waiting there until they all left for home. A very thoughtful young father went home, feeling rather sad because he saw now that the rift between him and the older man would now be much wider. And this grieved him greatly. He didn't even think for one moment about whether he'd been offended or not. That thought never entered his head. He didn't go home brooding about how badly he'd been treated, to be bawled out in front of the whole congregation, to be belittled and exposed in front of all these people. That thought never entered his head. He was only concerned about the overall effects as far as the truth was concerned. Well, he got home late on the Saturday afternoon and went into his study and picked down, more or less at random, one of the reprints of the Ellen G. White Review and Herald articles, and was looking through the very first volume when he came across this statement which told him that if he allowed his children to play ball upon the Sabbath day, he was just as guilty himself as if he'd played ball on that day. What he said. I never quite realized it was as serious as that. And so he called the children in and sat them down, and they had a nice little study together on how to keep the Sabbath day. And the father told those children, and there was a very good relationship in the family, in a kindly but decided way, what God expected of them and what he expected of them from that time on. And next Sabbath, of course, was much better. So the next Sabbath came, and nothing was said between the old and the younger man. They just sort of stood a distance from each other, still further apart. The younger man was friendly. He showed no malice. He talked to the older man as usual, but the older man kind of held off as if the younger man would bear a grudge toward him, which didn't exist. Then came the following Tuesday evening, which was now about 10 days after the incident down at Byron Bay. And as was their custom, they got together for their prayer meeting. Now, present was a very, very small company. Just the older man and another brother and the wife of the older man and the young preacher. And I was there to observe it all. Well, they had their prayer meeting, so the young preacher gave the study. They had their season of prayer. Then at the end of it, the younger man said to the older man, "Sir, this coming Sabbath I have to go up to Queensland. I wonder if you'd be so kind as to conduct the sermon down at Byron Bay this Sabbath." The older man looked at him straight in the eye and said, "No." The younger man said, "Why not?" And the older man said, "I have made up my mind, I am never going to Byron Bay again." And I saw a faint smile appear on the face of the younger man, because he understood exactly what was going on in the older man's mind. And he also understood that this was the grand and glorious opportunity he'd been praying for them to come into perfect unity. And he also understood there was only one way to do it, and that was for him to die completely and absolutely, to give up his life on that occasion, because by so doing, he'd save his life. Now, he knew what the trouble was, but he said to the older man, "Well, what's the trouble? Why won't you go to Byron Bay again?" And the older man drew himself up very stiffly and sternly and said, "If I told you, I'd offend you, so I shan't tell you." The younger man said to him, "Come now," he said, "how can I make matters right if you want to tell me what's in your heart?" And the wife of the older man, spoiling for a fight, said, "Go on, tell him, tell him." And she was there egging him on. And the younger man waited, the picture of calmness and serenity. And finally, the older man plucked up courage and in a very stern voice, he said to the younger man, "When I saw how you let your boy play ball on the Sabbath day, I made up my mind I was never going to Byron Bay again, and that's that." And now he was really braced off for a fight. He expected the young man to come back and say to him, "Very good, very good. But look here, old fellow, was that the way to treat me, to bawl me out across the yard like that? The scripture says you ought to come quietly, alone, and point out to a man his faults. And if he won't hear you, bring two or three more. If he still won't hear you, then bring the whole church. But you shouted me across the yard, you owe me an apology." Couldn't he have said that? Why, sure he could have. And if he'd done that, he'd have been justifying himself, and he'd been seeking to save whose life. And what would he have done? He'd have absolutely lost it. He'd lost all respect and so forth in the older man. I waited with bated breath to see what would happen. And very quietly the young man said to the older one, so quietly, so gently, "Sir," he said, "I want to thank you for what you did down there the other day." Imagine that. He said, "You alerted me to something of which I was only dimly aware before. And when I went home, I found there in the Word of God, where Sister White said, that if we let our children play upon the Sabbath day, we're just as guilty as if we'd done the thing ourselves. And so," he said, "I gathered my children around me, I gave them some very careful instruction on Sabbath keeping and what I expected of them. And they listened, and I believe they got the message," said this young father, this young preacher. Now, he said to the older man, "How was their behavior last Sabbath?" And the older man, kind of nonplussed by this approach, said, "Well," he said, "I find no fault with them last Sabbath." And now, said the younger man, "I've done my part. How about you go to Byron Bay next Sabbath?" As long as I live, I'll never forget that scene. Never. The older man didn't know which way to look. He didn't know what to say. Didn't know which way to turn. He was absolutely floored. He expected a fight. He expected the young man to come back self-justifying and demanding an apology of him, because in his heart he knew he owed one. In his heart he knew he had done the wrong thing and made the wrong approach. But instead of that, the younger man absolutely denied himself and completely died and made no effort to justify himself whatsoever, and honoured the older man not for his technique and method, which was wrong, but for his sincerity and zeal for God, which was right. You see the point? And the older man said, "Well, I guess I'll go." And you know, those two men from that day to this have been the closest of friends, the dearest of brothers, and nothing would part them. They respect each other and they love each other. You can't justify yourself without the world knowing what you're doing. You can't do it. And if somebody owes you an apology, you are not the one to go and demand it, to seek it, or in any way to suggest it. The only thing that you have to do in regard to that person is to go to them and make right what you have done wrong, irrespective of the fact that they may owe you a mountain of apology and you only owe them a tiny little bit. And if they don't apologize to you, don't go away fretting and worrying about it. Simply go away knowing that you have done this day's duty this day. I was out in Tennessee a few days ago. I met a brother there who'd been across to another camp meeting, not one of our camp meetings, and the man in charge of it had taken a very, very grave dislike to him, apparently. This particular man is not altogether... he speaks up sometimes and gets people's... they misunderstand him and whatnot. And So this man came there and got him ruffled, and he, I think, spoke a few words back in reply, which was a little bit out of place. But afterwards he felt bad about it, went back and apologized to the leader of this camp meeting for his response to his approach. But the leader of the camp meeting remained stiff and cold and distant from him. Well, when I met that man later, he was still worrying because the other man hadn't made an apology to him. And he asked me, should I write to him again and apologize again? Well, I said, no, because in your mind, what you're worried about is the fact that he hasn't apologized to you. That's what you're worried about. But I said, you have made things right on your side. Now, what more does God expect of you? Learn to die, because deep down that man, if he only knew his own feelings, was seeking to save his own life and get back from the other man an apology to put him on the right side. Now, we stand today in the shadow of the last Sabbath of this camp meeting. Tomorrow we shall meet together to part again for 12 months, or maybe until Jesus comes. Who knows what this next year may bring? As we're told in the spirit of prophecy, the last movements will be rapid ones, and we might find that by this time next year we shall be in any place but a camp meeting. Who knows? I don't, nor do you. Tomorrow, of course, we shall meet around the Lord's table, and today is the preparation day for that meeting. How important then that every person in this camp meeting solemnly and closely examine their hearts and ask themselves the question, do I need to lose my life today that I may save it, in going to a brother or a sister and humbly and honestly telling them that I have done them wrong, my intention may have been good and all that, but I've done them wrong and I need to make this thing right. Now, if we can do that without fear, as that young man did back then, his confidence in God was so great, and his understanding of God's principles so clear, that in the calmest possible way he could sit there in the presence of that older man, and in the presence of the others who are witnesses of it, and humbly and plainly thank that man for what he'd done to him. Now, I believe that man really understood the gospel, this message, and lived it, and you were meant to lose his life that he might save it and in turn save the life of others. And I believe the older man today has the experience he has because of what that young man did that day. Now, the older man to this day, as far as I know, has never actually come and made right his wrong action in bawling him out across the yard. And I don't suppose he really has to, because his intention was good and he did the best he knew, and all that was wrong was the technique of doing it. And, if I did that, I'd be guilty too, but I wouldn't make him guilty for it. I'll lead God to be his judge, and he does have a good experience, and they walk together in good fellowship. So I trust and pray and appeal to you folk, as you go through this day, to make it a real preparation day for the day which is coming tomorrow. And if you can have such a faith in God and a trust in God as to make all wrongs right and enter into the closest of unity with everyone on this campground, then what a blessing God will give us on the morrow. What a blessing. So may it be that each one of us will catch the vision and do that, that God may be honored, we all be drawn nearer to each other, and not spoil the opportunity which tomorrow brings. May God bless you, each one to this end on this preparation day, is my prayer.